Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, this is just a little content warning that this episode of Irrational Fear will cover issues of sexual assault.
This podcast is supported in part by the Bertha Foundation.
Hello, Lewis.
Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm well. I want to say a big thank you to new and returning Patreon supporters. We've had Patreon supporters that have gone away and have come back, which is really exciting news for everyone.
I can understand the first part. The second part is a real mystery.
I know. A big thank you to Gus McNall, Danny Reed, and Pete Lawler, who have all joined up in Patreon this week. Big thank you to everyone. How are you, Lewis? You okay?
Oh, I'm all right, Dan. I mean, it's been a bit of a week.
That's why we're here. We'll kick off. I'm recording my end of Irrational Fear on the land of the Tharawal. Sovereignty was never ceded. We need a treaty. Let's start the show.
Irrational Fear contains naughty words like Brexit, Canberra, fair dum, and Section 40. Irrational Fear recommends listening by immature audiences.
Tonight, Attorney General Christian Porter has heard rumours that he's taking a short leave of absence but doesn't know any specifics. And Channel 7 cast Chappelle Corby in Dancing with the Stars because Mark Chopper Reid was unavailable. And the UN chief demands Australia ends its deadly addiction to coal by 2030. In response, Scott Morrison broke into the UN chief's house, stole his VHS recorder and sold it for a lump of the good stuff. It's the 5th of March 2021 and no journalist has ever asked me about this podcast. This is Irrational Fear.
Irrational Fear.
Hello, welcome to Irrational Fear. I'm your host, former Duke of Essex, Dan Illich. Irrational Fear is the podcast that holds your hand through the scariest forest of news, and we're doing it this week, so let's meet our fearmongers for tonight. She spends her days wading through the rubble of trouble from the Canberra bubble. It's Amy Remakis.
Hello. That's a very nice way of putting it. I wade through the piles of shit. That's my job. That's what I do.
Amy, how are your rage levels as of today for this week?
Oh, I am incandescent with rage. I don't think I've screamed burn it all down so often in my life. And that was just Monday. So, you know, it's been going great.
And he's one of Australia's most prolific comedy creators. He quit journalism for the stability of comedy. It's Adam Zwar. Hello, Adam. Any regrets about leaving journalism after a week like this?
It was a wise decision, wasn't it? I'm exhausted and I'm not even involved in any way. So I can't imagine how you feel, Amy. Full on.
It's lucky you got out, Adam. You would have been joining the mob of media bullies.
You do realize I was the lightweight among journalists. I used to write show business journalists. You know, I used to,
that is one of the nastiest bits to be in show business journalism. I wouldn't want to come across you in a dark alley.
Yeah, I've been on the nasty end of a Peter Ford quip on A Current Affair where he said, Dan Illich, I've never heard of him.
I think he's blocked me on Twitter. I don't think we've had any interactions, and then just one day I discovered I was blocked on Twitter and I was like, who even are you, Peter Ford?
And our final fearmonger is considering becoming a celebrant. I've already booked him to officiate my funeral. It's Lewis Hobber.
Hello, Dan. Did I tell you that? I actually did drunkenly consider becoming a celebrant.
Well, I think you should. I mean, you're tall, you're handsome, you're good with your voice.
Thank you. I mean, I don't think there any of those are relevant qualifications to be a celebrant at a wedding. But because I get, I'm sure you guys get this as well. If you talk into a microphone professionally, you get asked to MC every wedding. Like yep. I've MC'd more weddings than I've attended. And occasionally, people do pay me to DJ. So if I could add celebrant, then I could literally be the whole wedding.
Coming up, ecosystems all around Australia and the Antarctic are suffering huge levels of decline and are on the brink of collapse. Joining us to discuss which ecosystem is likely to be last and where you should be building your eco-doom bunker is Climate Councillor Leslie Hughes. But first, a message from our sponsor.
It's the Harvey Norman swimming in money sale. There's so much money, we're drowning in it. Profits up 116%. Sales up by $462 million. As a bonus, we're keeping JobKeeper. That's right, $22 million from the government to help struggling businesses during the pandemic. The only thing we're struggling to do is find space to put all this excess cash. $22 million. Tax-free. Interest-free. No cash back.
The savings are huge at Harvey Norman. If you're me, Jerry Harvey.
It's the Harvey Norman swimming in money sale. All cash has got to stay, stay, stay.
Bit of a long tail out on that one. This week's first fear. The Attorney General, Christian Porter, claims he is innocent of any allegations of sexual assault in 1988. He was adamant that the allegations that he himself hadn't seen were completely false. It was an extraordinary press conference this week. Porter claimed that no one put to him the allegations ever. I think what he meant to say was, I hadn't seen or heard anyone putting the allegations to me, because if the Attorney General knew how to read his emails or pick up a phone from the hundreds of journalists trying to put the allegations to him, then maybe he would have. He also had the gall to suggest that the media were trying to, quote, ruin his life, forgetting that someone's life was literally ruined. Worst of all, consequences for Porter is that he would have to step down from politics and go to work in a law firm for four times the money that he's on now. It's a bit like Schrodinger's career. Inside is a box and you're not quite sure whether the career is alive or dead, and the only way to find out is if you open the box. But no way. No one wanted to open that box, not even a series of successive prime ministers. The AG's job is very important to him. After all, the twice-divorced Porter only has his job. It's not like he can quit to spend more time with his families because they don't want to be near him. It was a very, very strange press conference indeed. Fearmongers, what were your strangest moments from this remarkable presser? Amy, let's start with you.
I mean, it does have to be said straight up that he does absolutely deny it even happened at all, that there was any sort of consensual relationship between him and the complainant. And he just says it hasn't happened at all. And I have to put that out there for legal reasons, because this is a live legal issue. He has already said that he is trawling through social media and news stories and the like for defamation. So he denies everything. The most extraordinary part of the press conference for me, apart from some random memory of a bowl of prawns that he mentioned he remembered from the 1988 period in question from the complainant, was that he basically said that he would be, if this was independently investigated or if there was an independent inquiry, he would be the first person in history to have to disprove something that never happened. And to me, that was extraordinary, because that's the basis of every not guilty or denial plea that's ever been made. You're saying it doesn't happen. That's part of it. If you're saying it doesn't happen, then you are asked to explain your side of the story. It's not unique. And then when he went on to say that the rule of law would collapse if he was asked to go through some sort of other inquiry, because, you know, anyone could make any sort of allegation and it would immediately ruin a MP's career, which again is not true. You have independent inquiries all the time in the sports world, in churches, in schools, in businesses. It's not an either or situation.
That line, if he said, when he said if he stepped down, it would mean the end of the rule of law. That was quite a very strange line. Like, I think we all remember when the Pope retired, Catholicism disappeared. I think it's the same sort of thing, same sort of logic he's going for there.
It is wild that he sort of had this like vision that if a man is ever actually, or a politician is ever actually convicted of a sex crime, the next day it's the Thunderdome.
Well, true, yes. But like that's the other point though, is that we're not even talking convictions. This is not going to a criminal court. It can't. The complainant has passed away. They passed away before they made an official complaint. They withdrew it before their death. There was never any formal interview process. The police literally cannot investigate this. There is no way that they can. So this is never going to a criminal court. The only way you have to test whether he is fit to sit in the ministry is an independent inquiry, which has to be called by the Prime Minister. And he's not even being asked to resign. He's just basically being asked to maybe step aside while this inquiry is carried out, which is something that happens all the time. It's extraordinary that we've now reached these peaks of just, it's going to burn down democracy and the rule of law if we look into this any further. And the fact that the government is just picking up that line and running with it, and the Prime Minister is pretending to be a passive bystander. He's like, oh, well, you know, the police have had their say. There's nothing I can do. And people believe it is extraordinary to me.
It's such a passing of the buck again of all kinds of responsibility. Like, this is exactly the ScoMo playbook. It's like, it's not my problem. It's somebody else's problem. It's not our problem. It's not our fault. It's not my responsibility. It's just continually passing the buck. 7:30s, Laura Tingle made a point that back in the olden days that some people had shame and that politicians would resign that over the slightest smell of impropriety. I think one of the ones that sticks out to my mind was Peter Reith, like having a massive scandal around Peter Reith's telecard, which is his telecom card that he gave to his son, that his son racked up $40,000 or $50,000 worth of phone calls on. I don't even know how you could do that, and that almost brought down the government. But like nowadays, politicians are just sticking around; they're just sticking to their guns and toughening out until they pass through. What do you think is driving this trend?
Going back to times when people just resigned over almost nothing. There was a resignation because someone took a Paddington Bear toy into Australia without declaring it and paying tax. There was a resignation because an MP imported a colour television and he put down that it was a black and white television, so he didn't pay the proper amount of tax on that, and he resigned over that. Like, it's just, we've gone from that to a point where we have had sports rorts, and we've had, you know, questions over Angus Taylor's involvement in, like, you know, certain other projects. Then we've had bullying allegations during the Liberal Party leadership spills, like the many, many Liberal Party leadership spills. Then we've had the handling of the Brittany Higgins allegations, and now we have a rape allegation, and we've still got a Prime Minister saying, I don't hold a hose or an inquiry. It's just insane to me.
I think I don't hold a hose is going to be the meme of his tenure. That will be the symbol of his entire Prime Ministership. Adam, what do you think about that?
I agree. I remember there was a time when people resigned. I think they probably started, they stopped resigning around 2017, 2018. I remember... Barnaby Joyce, he left the leadership of the Liberal Party, of the National Party in 2018. I think that was the last resignation I can remember, really. Al Franken, who was the senator, I remember it, that was 2017, that there was an accusation that he forced a woman to kiss him, and then he demanded an investigation into himself, and I think seven other women came forward. And so he resigned. right now you've got Andrew Cuomo. He's not going anywhere. Three women have come out accusing him of sexual harassment. Trudeau, three times he was photographed in blackface. Attorney General of Virginia, Mark Herring, blackface again. All those people are holding firm. And I think it's, you know, we can blame Trump, but I think it actually goes back to Boris Johnson when he, there was, a number of scandals that he was involved in that just didn't touch the sides with him. It's something about those guys that just, they just huge hide, don't care what you think, kind of love the fight. You know, Boris Johnson had multiple affairs. He doesn't admit to how many children he's got.
Well, that's a great start. That is. I don't hold a penis, mate. That is.
Or a condom, apparently.
Yeah, it's totally fine. Yeah. It's obfuscation right there. There was an article in Nine Papers today that said ScoMo praised Porter's gutsy performance. Is ScoMo the world's most powerful drama teacher, Adam's well?
Yeah, he takes the acting really seriously because as we know, he was a child actor in the Vix ads back in the day. And
do people know this, that he was a child actor in a Vix vapor drops ad in the 70s and 80s?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
We're struggling to find out which ad it actually is. It's kind of hard because, there's not a kind of a fat bald kid in any of the ads. It's just like cute kids with hair, and how do you kind of pick out ScoMo? There's I can see the tricks of the trade that he's using. You know, when he was talking about the Jenny thing the other day, and he was saying that when Jenny, he had talked about it with Jenny, and, Jenny said, think about it if it was one of your daughters. He thought he was in a Ken Loach film when he was doing that. He was really searching for the meaning, and he was like really loading those pauses, You've got to be a lovey to know that shit. He knows. And when he's standing behind people talking, they've discussed the talking points beforehand.
Yeah.
And it's almost as though his lips are moving. Like he's kind of getting a little bit impatient with that they're not delivering the lines as well as he would have. And, he kind of does. He in his smirky, horrible way, he's a strong performer, whether you like him or not. He holds up. He keeps holding up despite the evidence being against him all the time.
Well, that performance, I think, that he does with the pauses, it's very reminiscent of a genuinely angry dad when you're a child. Like, I think when you're getting told off by a dad and he yells at you and then there's a silence, that grabs you as everyone remembers that being yelled at like that. But the problem is that he's starting to double up on the same performance. So there was this one where he did that performance. He was like, come on, you know this. And then there was the exact thing from a year ago where he does the same performance, but the point of the performance a year ago was that he's yelling at journalists because he's like, there's problems all over the place. Women are getting raped and we're not listening to them. And you're like, these performances are really now clashing.
Yeah. That's not the tone we need for this particular point of view right now.
Well, you get other takes, don't you? You get another take if you don't get it right.
Lighten it up, Scott. One more. Well, Scott, I love what you're doing. We've got that one.
That's right.
Scott's always got another doorstop to get to, so he can always try it out again there.
That's it, yeah.
Amy, I want to ask you this. I don't know if you're across this, but I saw that Porter could possibly have his fate decided for him by the AEC by the time the next election rolls around because of a whole demographic shift from WA to Victoria. The AEC is planning on abolishing Porter's seat of Pierce. Is this the most humane way to put Porter down?
I don't know about that. It is a very live issue for WA politics at the moment, whether, Porter's seat will exist. And it's going to be very interesting from a purely political viewpoint of how much political capital he still has in the WA branches, because usually when this sort of stuff happens is the heavyweights get to move into somebody else's safe seat and that person ends up resigning. So you see those battles happen, kind of everywhere. I mean, Labor went through one in Victoria when Melbourne had a whole bunch of, reselections in terms of where the boundaries were going and that sort of thing. There was a lot of shuffling around and who got to go where.
Craig Kelly's now an independent. Hughes is looking pretty attractive. Maybe Porter could be put in for Hughes.
I think I think he'll probably stay in WA. There was some talk at the time that he might want Julie Bishop's old seat and that he was making a move for that even back then because it's a much safer seat than his is. But it really is going to depend on how the next couple of weeks / months like play out. And when you're talking about Morrison's performance, and I refuse to call him ScoMo because that is a nickname he gave himself. It is a marketing name. You cannot allow the man to just create like the man, the myth, the legend with a nickname he gave himself. So we need to like, you know, move on from the ScoMo talk. But he performs mostly for the televisions, and those pauses are for the grabs. He just wants the TVs to have a neat cut of him saying his very profound statement, cut one, cut two, boom. That's all anybody hears from the Prime Minister, and everyone moves on. Because I think if we remember about politics, one of the key rules is that you don't want people thinking about politics, because if you think about politics, you'll begin to pay attention to what the government's doing. And if you're doing that, you will probably vote them out. He doesn't want you thinking about it. He wants you just ignoring it, going, oh, that's just a Canberra Parliament bubble thing. Move on. How about them Sharkies?
What I was talking about with the pauses was the my daughter's thing. He was trying to tap into an emotional place there to show us that he was human. And in doing so, just looked worse than normal, I thought. I thought he was actually trying to go a little bit too far. And being a child actor, as we know with all child actors, they don't develop into proper actors. They retain just like really two-dimensional kind of truths that they search for, and it's on the nose.
I imagine if we ever go back and find that Vix ad, it'll just be some kid coughing desperately and a young ScoMo going, I don't hold a Vix, mate.
Irrational fear. That's a matter for the Queensland government.
I mean, that's a matter for the Premier.
That's a matter that I'll raise with other Premiers and Chief Ministers.
That's really a question to the Premier.
That's a matter I'm happy to take up with the other Premiers and Chief Ministers.
Irrational fear.
Let's move on to our second fear this week. As mentioned at the top of the show, there's a new wildcard entry for Dancing with the Stars, Chappelle Corby, which makes me ask the question, have TV producers run out of genuine Australian stars now? Fearmongers, are we going to call Chappelle a star here? Who else should be given a crack at Dancing with the Stars? I've got a small list. Ned Kelly, George Pell, Martin Bryant. Martin Bryant's still alive. He'd be, you know, we could get him on Dancing with the Stars.
I like Chappelle on Dancing with the Stars, but I think it should be kind of like a 90s rave. Like she should just throw down three pills and then the episode goes for 12 hours. We just see how long she can shuffle for.
This is really sad for NIDA graduates, I've always thought. I thought NIDA graduates graduating NIDA now have to go and commit some extremely drastic crimes overseas so they can get cast on these shows.
Like, let's remember, though, Pauline Hanson was a star on this show after she had, you know, got out of jail, after she was, you know, wrongly convicted or expunged or whatever they ended up saying there. And before she was back in politics, we ran out of stars a very, very long time ago. I mean, I think we went through whoever was in Neighbours and Home and Away that wasn't a Hemsworth. And then I think maybe they dug up some, like, you know, people from Better Homes and Gardens. Then they went through some, like, you know, I don't know, the Block contestants. And then they were like, oh, who else? Who's coming out of jail now? Pauline Hanson, come on down.
Yeah, but the reality TV pipeline now is just kind of like an Escher sketch where you try to walk out of Maths and you accidentally walk onto the Block. And then when you leave, all of a sudden you're on X Factor and you can never leave.
You're in Bachelor in Paradise and then you're stuck in that island and you find yourself in Survivor and then you're just all like, you know, putting out a raft somewhere and it's, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And it's this never-ending Dante circle of like reality TV.
What about the cast of Insiders? Phil Curry on Dancing in the Stars. David Marr.
I would pay to watch that, actually. I would pay
Amy Remikus on Dancing with the Stars. There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would, you know, probably drop some really unfortunate swear word and then just get voted off and then just go straight into my next reality TV show.
And you're all dancing with your mobile phones? You're watching your mobile phones?
Yeah, I am. I'm just all like, do you see what the fuck they've done, that would be all of my routines.
Adam, you're an executive producer of many TV shows. Is this is it appealing to you to cast Chappelle in something?
Do you know what? I saw SAS Australia, I watched that with interest. It's the only Channel 7 show I think I've watched in the last, you know, decade. I really liked it. And Chappelle, I was very skeptical of when she came on, but she was so lovely. She's a very sensitive, nice person. That's how she came across anyway. And she won me over. I was actually a little bit moved when she got voted out. I mean, she was terrible at SAS. She shouldn't be anywhere near, you know, she shouldn't be running 10 kilometers with a backpack on.
And no one should.
No. And she was okay. So she's not going to be any good at dancing. She'll be voted off in the first week, but, you know, she'll be sweet about it and take some money. I definitely think it was her brother who did it.
Irrational Fear.
This is Irrational Fear.
Turning now to a topic close to this podcast heart, the end of the world. A groundbreaking report has just been released to say that 19 ecosystems around Australia are at major threat of collapse. That is, they are deteriorated so badly they are unlikely to recover, a bit like my older brother's hairline. It's never coming back, and I feel like I'm next. One of the authors of the report and longtime friend of the show is Professor Leslie Hughes. Leslie joins us now. Thank you, Professor Hughes, for joining us.
Hi, Dan. Great to be here.
So 19 ecosystems doesn't sound like a lot, but when you see it mapped out across the continent the way that the report has it, it feels like the whole of Australia is in peril. Is it imminent collapse period?
Well, in some cases, yes. The ecosystems, as you can see on the map in the paper, go from right at the northern tip, right down through the continent, right from east to west, and then down to Antarctica. They're spread out all over the place. Some of them are ecosystems that are really well known, like the Great Barrier Reef, and others will be ones that most people haven't heard of, but they're all in trouble.
The ones that people haven't heard of, do they need some kind of PR campaign? Is that something that we can help out with?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, some of them aren't quite as spectacular as the Great Barrier Reef or the Murray-Darling Basin, but they're all in trouble. They all have species that are disappearing. They all provide services to our health and well-being. In some cases, they've been in trouble for a very long time, whereas in other cases, the evidence of decline has been quite rapid and quite recent.
Where are the ones that the evidence of decline has been rapid? Like, what are the ones that have kind of, you know, fallen over pretty quickly?
Well, we've seen things. Well, coming back to the Great Barrier Reef, you know, in the last 5 years, we've had three major bleaching events from underwater heat waves, and that's resulted in about 50% of loss of all of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef. If you think about a reef system, you can see it from space. It's more than 2,000 kilometres long, and we've lost half the corals. That's a pretty major event, and it's actually happened, you know, in geological time very, very rapidly. And then a couple of years ago, for example, just over the space of a couple of days, we had massive fish kills in the Menindee Lakes as a result of drought and heat and loss of water, with millions of fish dying in the space of 2 or 3 days. So some of these things can happen really, really fast.
What does this kind of collapse mean for Australia's ability to feed itself, to kind of, you know, provide agriculture for itself and as an agriculture nation?
Well, indeed. Two of the ecosystems that we mention in the report are the Murray-Darling waterways and the Murray-Darling sort of what we call riparian vegetation, which is the vegetation around the river. Over the last few decades, there's been a massive decline in rainfall. And on top of that, of course, we're removing lots of that water for irrigation and for urban uses. And those two things together, together with, you know, runoff of nutrients and sediment from agricultural fertilizers, are really destroying those ecosystems. And the Murray-Darling Basin is where we produce a third of our food. So when you've got those ecosystems that are so intricately entwined with our life support system in the form of our food security, there's some really serious things going on.
Man, it sounds dire. Like, it sounds like there's nowhere to go.
Is there any positive to look at it? Can we eat the fish from the Menindi Lakes, or can we take the bleached coral and use it to decorate Byron Bay Airbnbs?
Well, yeah, you can't eat bleached coral, and I guess you'd have to get to the fish pretty fast before they poisoned you. So there's always some creative things that you could do with destroyed ecosystems, but it would be better to do something positive to stop and then reverse this decline.
Is there an ecosystem that's thriving right now? Is there a place in Australia that's like, hell yeah, this is great, woo?
You know, I can't think of one.
God damn it, Leslie. Come on.
I'm sorry. I mean, if you think back to the Black Summer bushfires, for example, the amount of area burnt in those fires is about three times the size of Tasmania. It's about 20% of our eucalypt forests burnt that summer. So, you know, that's just the East Coast and a bit of Western Australia.
I was just saying, I'm in Jervis Bay right now, and we've been driving up and down the South Coast, and for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kilometres, it is just recovering forests. And it's so stark to drive through these places that I remember seeing on the news a year ago, thinking, wow, like this is just so epic, the amount of bushland that was burned over that summer. And it's only kind of recovering now. And I'm just thinking about all the wildlife that has gone missing, particularly over that strange, dark period.
Yes, yeah, so one of my colleagues at the University of Sydney estimated that around about 3 billion vertebrate animals, that's birds, mammals and reptiles, probably directly perished in the fires, and of course many more would have died of starvation and predation afterwards. So, but look, the eucalypt forests that you've been driving through are recovering. They'll you know, they're fairly well adapted to fires, but the really different thing about that summer's bushfires is that we had massive fires go through rainforests, the Gondwana rainforests that don't burn usually. We had some a few years ago in the Tasmanian World Heritage Area that killed trees that were 1,000 years old. So what we're seeing with climate change increasing the severity and intensity and frequency of these fires is places burning that have never burnt in the last 1,000 years.
With this work that you've just kind of released, it's a big job to kind of categorize every kind of ecosystem in Australia and put it through that filter. How did this job kind of come about? How did this piece of work get built?
Well, there was a workshop down in Canberra at the Academy of Sciences in 2018 that brought a number of us together to talk about what we called ecological surprises. And a number of people spoke at that conference, including myself. And when the people at the conference got together afterwards, we sort of sat around and thought, well, look, we really should write something up so that this, what's been talked about at the conference, can be on paper and disseminated beyond these walls. And so really for the last couple of years, that paper has been put together. More and more people came on board who were expert in particular ecosystems. It's been a massive job. There's a massive amount of data and references in this paper. But finally, to all of our great relief, it was published last week.
I mean, given that there's, you know, 19 ecosystems, you've got the Great Barrier Reef in there, one of the most famous in Australia and the world, we still can't get anyone to do anything about that. The most famous one that we know generates billions of dollars of tourism. There's still nothing they can do about that, let alone the other 18. When you get together with your group who have made these discoveries, what's the mood?
It's a good question. I think anybody that works both in environmental conservation and climate change, and I work in both of those areas, kind of gets pretty used to being depressed about it all most of the time. You know, you do have to get hardened to it, which doesn't mean that you give up and stop going, but nothing much surprises you anymore. You know, we sort of expect the worst, and on occasion when we get a small victory, we celebrate that. But generally they are small and fleeting victories against a backdrop of really extraordinary loss. But, I mean, the alternative is to just crawl under your doona and ignore it and hope that it all goes away or gets better, and really that's not really an option for most of us.
I'm glad it's not an option for you, Leslie. That's great. Yeah. It's great. Great.
My daughter gets a lot of work.
Last time we hung out was in Paris at the climate talks. You are a representative on the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. We're heading into COP26 in Glasgow. First of all, what is COP26 going to look like in this kind of pandemic situation that we've got? Is it going to be face-to-face?
Look, we don't know. I mean, I guess with the vaccine rollout, especially in places like the UK, which seems to be going pretty well, I think we would hope that it would be at least partially face-to-face. Of course, the Glasgow meeting was supposed to happen last year and didn't happen at all. So there's another year down the track and emissions keep going up. I think one of the really major things that will be different about this year, whether it's in person or not, is the fact that Joe Biden's administration has put climate change front and centre. So that's given an enormous boost of hope going forward. And I think that the atmosphere in Glasgow this year will be very different to what it might have been last year under the Trump administration. So whether it's in person or not, that's a really important difference.
And I don't want to kind of put you on the spot here, but what do you think Australia is going to take to Glasgow? Do you think Australia is going to be a better actor than it has been at previous conferences of parties?
Well, look, you've just been talking earlier in the podcast about this government's ability to just sort of solder on unchanged, regardless of extraordinary scandal. The government's attitude to climate change is also an extraordinary scandal, but they've proved thus far to be able to sort of tough out all sorts of things. So my prediction would be is we'll go to Glasgow with no further level of ambition than we took to Paris, despite all evidence that that is not enough. I'd love to be surprised by that.
Like, even with Europe and the UK starting to think about financial penalties for and tariffs on high carbon countries, do you think that'll change what we take to Glasgow at all?
Well, it might do. In fact, I think that's probably the only thing that will turn this government around to being a better player in this space. You know, if places like the EU and the US start to impose carbon tariffs on countries like Australia who are not pulling their weight, then we will have to change because we are so reliant for our economy on our trade. So, you know, it's sad that we should be dragged kicking and screaming to that position when Australia has so much to earn from renewables and green manufacturing.
It does seem like Australia has two options. One, that option, the smart one. Two, Jenny starts to care and tells Scott.
It's the battle for Jenny.
You know, we should put it to Scott that his kids and grandkids are going to live, hopefully, into the next century. And if we carry on the way we're going with 3 degrees or more of temperature increase, that is pretty much an uninhabitable world that those kids and grandkids are going to be inheriting. So if he really does care about his kids, if anybody cares about their kids and future generations, they should be absolutely as passionate about climate action as I am.
And Leslie, as part of this big bit of work that you've released this week, you've kind of put together a bit of a scheme called the 3 A's, a way that people can kind of do their kind of get involved with their own action in meaningful ways. What are the 3 A's?
Yeah, we wanted to put forward a sort of a framework of hope going forward. We didn't just want to catalogue the problems as so many of these sorts of papers do. So the first A is awareness, you know, and that's what we've been doing with is raising awareness about the true extent of the trouble that Australian ecosystems are in. The second is anticipation. If you can anticipate future decline, hopefully you can get in and do something about it before it happens. And the third A, of course, is action. And what we do in the paper is for each of those ecosystems, we outline a series of management actions that, if implemented, would help halt and possibly in some cases reverse the decline. Of course, most of those are local actions that address things like habitat clearing and over-allocation of fresh water and that sort of thing. But on top of all of that is the global action that we need on climate change.
If I was not a generous person, I'd ask you why there wasn't a fourth A, Angus Taylor. Why wasn't that on the list?
Well, Angus Taylor gets the prize for the most Orwellian named ministry, you know, the Minister of Emissions Reduction. that is wanting us to put in new coal-fired power stations. You know, it does beg a belief.
His absence as the fourth A is kind of a hole. It's an A-hole, the Angus Taylor.
Very good.
That's it for Rational Fear. Big thank you to all of our guests, Professor Leslie Hughes, Adam Zwa, Amy Romikas and Lewis Hobber. Have you got anything to plug? Amy, do you want to plug anything?
No, just speak to your MPs. Just be loud and angry and not at me at social media. Like, just take it to the people who represent you. It's the only way you're going to get action.
Adam Zwa, do you want to plug anything?
Nothing to plug, Dan, which is a relief, isn't it?
It's very good. Lewis Hobber, what are you plugging?
Nothing, Dan. No, this is the huge. Still doing the radio show. You can listen if you like, but, you know.
No big deal. Leslie Hughes, do you have anything to plug?
I'd like to plug the Climate Council, which is working very hard and now in our eighth year to inform the Australian public about climate change.
And for kids who are listening to this, ask your parents about what the Climate Council is and how it was formed. It was this incredible story over a two-week period where one government department got shut down and the Climate Council came together with a whole bunch of public donations, and it was absolutely remarkable. Very inspiring stuff. Now, Amy, on a personal note, thank you for your hard work this week. It's been so fun watching you on Twitter and heartening to see you at the coalface of such a very difficult story and helping all of us on Twitter in particular channel our rage as to what was going on. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for listening.
Big thanks to Roadmarks, the Bertha Foundation, our Patreon supporters, Jacob Round on the Teppanyaki Timeline, Rupert Dagas for his incredible voice, Killian David, Pete and all the Discord crew. Until next week, there's always something to be scared of. Good night.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.